Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Nicholas Lemon, whose new book is Returning, A Search for Home Across Three Centuries. Nick will be a featured speaker at the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University, coming up. It is always a pleasure to welcome the distinguished author Nicholas Lemon back to The Reading Life. Nick is a professor and dean emeritus of the Columbia Journalism School, the author of The Promised Land, The Big Test, Redemption, and Transaction Man. He has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1999, and today we're talking about his new book, Returning, A Search for Home Across Three Centuries. Nick Lemon, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So good to speak with you. Yeah. Now, like many of us, you saw yourself in this expansive New Orleans universe of fictional characters. Jack Burden from All the King's Men, Binks Bowling from The Moviegoer, Quentin Compson of Absalom Absalom, doubters, skeptics, observers, southerners.
Right. That was like mother's milk to me, was reading reading about these people and trying to sort of use them as a way to plug into a certain kind of consciousness about being a Southerner and a certain kind of aspiration for myself.
Now, you move into the real subject of returning with the story of your family, as well as your people, German Jews who emigrated to the American South. It's a long story beginning 300 years ago with the first of five generations to come to Louisiana. So tell us about them.
Well, let's see. So first of all, you know, Jews are a tiny group in the great American tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as is always the case with groups, we have subgroups. So for much of American history, the two most important American Jewish subgroups were German Jews and Eastern European Jews. German Jews came earlier in the 19th century and often came in the form of a single male. Eastern European Jews came later in much larger numbers and usually as entire families or even entire villages coming at once. A lot of the German Jews came to the South and a lot of them started out as peddlers, and that was my family. So my great-great-grandfather, Jacob Lemon, was born in a village called Essenheim, Germany, and came alone, landed in New Orleans on the dock in 1836 and made his way up the Mississippi River as a peddler and settled in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, which, as you know, is kind of two-thirds of the way from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. And I still have a lot of relatives living there today.
And the Lemons had a plantation and a store in Donaldsonville, didn't they?
Yeah, so it's you know, that you find things out when you research your family, and it was mm-hmm. a more complicated story than I thought, but in interesting ways. So they had a store, which was very typical for these Jewish peddlers. They would often start a store. I don't know if this is even still true, but in my youth, when you would drive through the really rural South, you get to a little town with a town square, and there'd be a dry goods store mm-hmm. called Cohen's or Levy's, you know, so that's our story, setting up these little stores. So the family, and this is what I had not known before I worked on the book, they actually relocated from Donaldsonville to New York City, where I live now, in the 1850s. Then, when the Civil War broke out, they relocated again and went back to Germany, to basically the place where my great-great-grandfather came from, and kind of rode out most of the war in Germany, and then came back to Donaldsonville. And at that point, my great-great-grandfather acquired a string of sort of medium-sized plantations in the area of Donaldsonville and went into the plantation business after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
They still have one plantation, by the way, that's operating.
Palo Alto, and it's a
wedding
venue and a hunting lodge. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Incredible. Now, soon enough, going through the archives, I want you to read this part for us. You come to records of your family's slave owning, which is something that people researching this period of history always come across. And I was really fascinated to read your reasoning through it, because I think it's a haunting moment, as it is for most people, to come to reckon with. I wonder if you'd mind reading that at the bottom of page 51.
I will. Let me just say as a prelude, what I just told you, some of it I knew and some of it I didn't know. What I knew, by the way, you probably know this too, there's two Jewish families in Louisiana with very similar history around owning plantations, and that's the Godshaws and us. Both families originated in the, you know, very near each other, although the Godshaws were from Alsace on the other side of the Rhine River. Okay, so in both families, you know, there's a Godshaw descendant named Peter Wolfe who's written a book. So in both families, this was the legend, was Civil War ends, you know, in the white South mind, it's like Gone with the Wind, you know, ruins everywhere. And the white Southern planters typically had insisted for years and believed very deeply the only way to run a plantation in the South was with enslaved labor. So the conventional wisdom was it was impossible. Our version was, no, this is actually an opportunity. So that's why they went into the plantation business with free labor. And sugarcane, people were actually paid wages, not sharecroppers. So we were sort of like patting ourselves on the back to some extent for this, and for being in the plantation business post-slavery. So then when I was working on the book, one of my stops was the Ascension Parish clerk's office, and there's a guy who works there named Brett Landry, and he did an incredible job of guiding me to what I needed to look at, and he just said in a matter-of-fact way, do you want to see the slave transactions? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. So he showed me a bunch of documents, or showed me how to find them, and I made copies. And I should give you the context of this, too. So I mentioned that, you know, these Jewish peddlers would come. And basically, one of the things I found out was, back in Germany, they were basically doing the same job. They were peddlers. But peddler can be construed a little more broadly to mean, you know, you wander up and down with your goods. Somebody might want to buy on credit, so you're a money lender. Somebody might want to sell you something that you sell to the next person down the line, so you're a merchant. You know, it's a sort of blend of retailing and finance.
Yes.
And so he was doing that, and he was doing better, he was buying and selling parcels of land and lending money to landowners. So I think this is the paragraph you want me to read. And I found a series of these transactions involving enslaved people. These are in the 1840s into the 1850s. Ever since I sat in the Ascension Parish clerk's office looking at these records, I can't get them out of my mind. As late as the 1930s, when one of the New Deal agencies paid for a project to translate the old records out of French into English and to type them up so they would be easier to read, the project was limited to land transactions, no livestock or black people. That's a sign of the ambient level of moral awareness in Louisiana back when it was casting nearly 90% of its votes for Franklin Roosevelt. And shouldn't Jacob Lemon, as a Jew, have seen the wrong in slavery? Evidently, he did not. The Torah, which is, you know, the Hebrew Bible, is full of references to slavery, treating it as something far below, say, idol worship on the scale of immorality. At best, one can say that the Torah tries to create rules for slaveholders, including Jewish ones, while exulting in the collective emancipation of the Jews as a people. Could Jacob have been obeying some inner compass that would be utterly foreign and offensive to us today? All I can do with these questions, given the opacity to me of Jacob's inner life, is to say that there is a direct causal connection between his involvement with slavery, which I would consider evil, even if he did not, and the life I'm able to live today. It's my job, not his, to do what I can to make amends, if that's even possible. I cannot remove slavery from our family's history, my history.
It's such a stunning moment, and you're so honest about it. That's what I admire the most.
Well, thanks. It's a hard thing to find out.
And, I'm sure.
You know.
And then moving forward, you continue to discover things that you didn't know when you were growing up. And you recount those on page 120.
There was so much of this history that I hadn't known when I was growing up. And when, all those years ago, I set my course as a person who investigates things that are not immediately visible, that form an unexcavated structure underlying the life I live. I hadn't known anything about my family's life in Germany, about the way we rose in antebellum Louisiana, my relatives' direct participation in slavery, their careers as mid-level financiers. I hadn't known about their relocation to New York, their re-engagement in Jewish life, their temporary return to Germany during the Civil War, or how they had acquired a string of plantations. What I knew was Palo Alto and the old B. Lemon and Brothers store in Donaldsonville, and our deeply rooted but only faintly Jewish lives as members of a prominent, many-branched family in New Orleans. I suppose you find out whatever you need to know in order to take the next few steps. What I can see now is that my relatives, our family's patriarchs and matriarchs, made what they probably understood as a practical decision to return to Louisiana, which wound up determining the way all of us who came from them have thought of ourselves down through the generations. We were Southerners first, Jews a distant second. That was what I was as a child and as a young man during the second half of the 20th century. Then, over time, something made me reverse the order. Learning more about our history was part of it. Another part is harder to explain. I think it's the idea that, no matter what the circumstances, being Jewish has a way of pushing itself to the fore. Because of how people who aren't Jewish think and act, because of how strongly it imprints itself unbidden, irresistibly, on our consciousness, because of what it offers, including both extraordinary treasures and a feeling of perpetual unease. In that last sense, it has a good deal in common with the way that, as an adolescent aspiring to life as a reporter and writer, I conceived of being Southern. But as I've learned about my family's history, I can see that it took quite some time for our decision to become Southerners to penetrate my relative self-conception fully, because for decades, like most Jews who have ever lived, they were still primarily Jews.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Lemon, whose new book is Returning, A Search for Home Across Three Centuries. This is so fascinating because as you move forward, a great chunk of this book is about the fascinating Jewish life of New Orleans, of
right.
Your grandfather, Monty Lemon, founder of Monroe and Lemon, Dillard University, his best friend, Edgar Stern, cotton broker, member of another German Jewish family, whose wife was the legendary Edith Stern, of course. This is like a roll call of great people who accomplished great things in the city and yet felt limited in some ways.
Right. Well, you know these old stories, that, and they're not so old.
No, they're really not.
You know, in New Orleans, there's certain sectors of the upper social life of the city that, as far as I know, as a non-full-time resident and for a long time, mm-hmm. still don't have any Jewish members. like famously the Boston Club,
right,
lunch club downtown. So that's something that we all grew up with. There was a famous article about this by Calvin Trillin in the New Yorker in the mid-1960s, but in general, it was not spoken of publicly. It was spoken of plenty privately. So it's this kind of weird status that's hard to describe, where we were definitely at the top of the heap in New Orleans in every possible way, but then there was this one thing where we were excluded.
Well, it's like near the end of his life, your father called you and asked if you wanted him to put you up for membership in the country club.
Right. Here's the sort of longer version of the story, and this was the mythology I was raised on. This goes back to German Jews and Eastern European Jews. So in the good old days, before the Eastern European Jews came, the German Jews were accepted everywhere. Then the Eastern European Jews came, and they were very numerous and poor and obviously different and sort of off-putting. So the rest of the world, to our astonishment, grouped us with them because we were all Jewish, mm-hmm. and said, no Jews allowed. So my grandfather, I believe, was one of the founding members of the New Orleans Country Club. But within a few years, maybe a couple decades, the club did not admit Jewish members. My father always told me that he was admitted as a sort of legacy of his father, and that if we wanted to be admitted, his children, we would have to be admitted under that exception, because otherwise we would not be.
Oh, Nick. The final section of the book, Returning, deals more particularly with your father's life and your upbringing. And you write that nothing could have been as secure, as serene, as likely to last forever as your environment, right down to the family Christmas tradition. I wonder how you avoided entering the family law firm.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, it also, as you, I'm sure, know, because Monroe and Lemon was the firm, and the Monroe descendant was Michael Lewis.
Yes.
So we were both supposed to enter the family law firm. I didn't want to for a bunch of reasons, and it felt kind of transgressive not to, but I just kind of took it one step at a time. I was very, very happy to be given an opportunity to start in journalism at the Courier, now of blessed memory, and then I just sort of charged into it and was, you know, very, very ambitious and determined to show my family that I could make being a journalist work. You know, it all worked out in the end, but my wife grew up in a family business, too. If you didn't grow up in a family business, it's very hard to explain to people how psychologically wrenching it can be to leave the family business, but it is.
Sure. And you were a family of writers and readers, too.
Right. I mean, I didn't know any of that was going to happen when I started out. I knew my parents were tremendous readers and were tremendous writers of things like letters and journals and things like that. But I don't remember that we actually knew anyone who was a writer professionally. It just seemed like a very distant thing. And then, you know, my sister became a novelist. And then after my mother passed away, my father married Sheila Bosworth, another novelist. So, you know, and then my sister's daughter, Emmeline Klein, just published her first book recently, but it didn't look like things were going to go that way when I started.
Well, I feel like this spring is Lemon Palooza. I mean,
yeah, it is, definitely. Yeah.
Your book, Nancy's book.
Yeah, at almost exactly the same moment.
I know, it's just amazing. So, and during this time, your father continued his project of trying to assimilate into social status.
Yeah, well, I guess he thought, you know, he had a sort of narrative in his head, which I started a minute ago, that, you know, the German Jews, like us, had been included, then they'd been excluded, and now his dream was we could be re-included, and that he would be kind of the tip of the spear of that project. So it didn't last, in retrospect, a long, long time. But there was a period there when I was growing up when there was a kind of attempt being made by my father and some of his old friends to get him and then our generation admitted to all these Mardi Gras crews and mm-hmm. clubs and things like that. And somehow it never completely took, but it was in the atmosphere that it kind of might happen. It was a strange thing to be kind of a semi-witness, semi-participant to. But one part of it was that we needed to be Jewish in a very un-Jewish way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, and that was meant to be kind of part of the project of our acceptability, I think. So we had a way of being Jewish that was very dissimilar to the way almost everybody else who's Jewish in the whole world is Jewish, and left the whole area as a mystery to me. That, and you know, a lot of the last part of the book is about trying to sort of figure out how to be Jewish in my own life when it was terra incognita to me.
But you seem to have found a very joyful way.
I have, yeah. It's a tremendous source of pleasure in my life, especially at this moment. I would say it's not without complications.
Of course.
But it has been a great sense of meaning and joy and routine, which I mean in a good way, and sustenance to me. It's a big part of my life.
Well, I'm curious, for you, when you were writing this book, did it feel different to you from writing your other books?
Very, yes. Absolutely. I mean, I managed to get up to a very advanced age without writing anything or publishing anything personal at all. And
yeah.
So it felt very, very different to write something about it that's extremely personal.
Well, you're doing it well, let me tell you. It's a fascinating book. And it's very moving. You know, your other books, you've gone off and you've traced social movements and history and great events. And this, you went out and got something you needed and you wanted, and you came back to tell us the story, and it's a very valuable one about New Orleans, about yourself, about the world.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad it landed that way with at least one esteemed reader. So, so thanks for that reaction.
Well, it's my pleasure. We've been talking with Nick Lemon, whose new book is Returning, A Search for Home Across Three Centuries. You can meet him at the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University coming up in March. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Writers Howard Hunter, Sally Reeves, and Hillary Irvin, and photographer David Spielman, contributors to New Orleans Garden District Profiles in Preservation, signed this new book Friday, February 27th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Taiba Kanbal reads from and signs Talking with Boys, Friday, February 27th at 7 at Blue Cypress Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library sponsor a warehouse and puzzle sale Saturday, February 28th from 9 to 4. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Books will be sold by the box and category, but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. The library's puzzle extravaganza is part of the sale, with puzzles at bargain prices, cash or credit card. Howard Hunter and Jason Berry discuss and sign Conversations with Jason Berry, Monday, March 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Barbara Dixon discusses and signs The Soul Instinct, Tuesday, March 3rd at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Annie DeFranco and her co-author, Laura Coyle Rosen, discuss their new book, The Sound of Annie, and appear, along with Boyfriend, Thursday, March 5th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Megan Poole appears in conversation with Boyce Uphold and signs Listening to Beauty, Rhetorics of Science in Sea and Sound, Thursday, March 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Coming up, the 5th Annual New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University gets underway March 12th through 15th. Among the more than 200 authors scheduled to appear are Stacey Abrams, Rick Atkinson, Jamie Attenberg, Charles Blow, David Brooks, Ken Burns, Anderson Cooper, Roxane Gay, Jeffrey Goldberg, Annette Gordon-Reed, Molly Jong-Vast, Katie Kitamura, Eric Larson, Nancy Lemon, Nicholas Lemon, Don Lemon, John Meacham, Governor Westmore, Sigrid Nunes, Elaine Pagels, Salman Rushdie, and Cleo Wade. Sunday is Family Day, an entire day devoted to children's books and reading activities. Check out the complete schedule at nola.bookfest.tulane.edu. Events are free, but registration is encouraged. The 40th Annual Tennessee Williamson New Orleans Literary Festival is March 25th through 29th. Primarily at the Hotel Monleon, but throughout the French Quarter. This year's special guests include Charles Baxter, Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, Thomas Keith, Martin Sherman, Justin Torres, Boyce Upholt, and Joshua Wheeler. The five-day event includes theatrical productions, walking tours, and a writing marathon. Tickets and info at TennesseeWilliams.net. The 23rd Annual Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival takes place March 27th through 29th, also at the Hotel Monleon. Featured speakers include Margot Dwahi, Robert Fiesler, Jewel Gomez, Daniel W.K. Lee, Thomas Mallon, Gene Redmond, Martin Sherman, Justin Torres, and many others. Events include panel discussions, a reading series, craft sessions, and walking tours. Tickets and info at sasfest.org.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.